Remember, tune in next week. We get more about Jamaica Day in the park of Cotonou, Jersey.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a man, you wanted to get a unit. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today we have a long interview for you with Ardeth Wynot. Ardeth is an associate professor at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick, and author of the book Insurgent Love, Abolition, and Domestic Homicide. The book is about the role of abolition in the fight against a particular kind of intimate partner violence that Ardeth calls intimate terrorism. And so this interview references intimate partner violence, coercive control dynamics, and murder. For anyone who might find this hard to listen to, we encourage you to find a friend to listen with or to talk about it with afterwards. This show is airing on August 11th, 2022, which means it is also our first show post August 10th. We wanted to take a moment to honor everyone we know who has died in prison and shout out our listeners on the inside who participate in Prisoner Justice Day by fasting or not working or both. There was an event last night in Montreal where we read out the names of people who have died in prison in the last year, and some people who have done time shared some words. We recorded the event, and our next August show will feature audio from Prisoner Justice Day, both in Montreal and across Canada. Our next show will air on August 26th, 11 a.m., so tune in then for more Prisoner Justice Day content. Without further ado, here is our interview with Ardeth Wynot. So I always like to start things by getting people to introduce themselves for our listeners. I know people possibly listened to the show that we aired in December where we had audio from a talk you gave in Montreal, but in case people haven't heard of you before, do you want to introduce yourself for our audience?
Yeah, my name is Ardeth Wynot, and I teach at Mount Allison University, and I live on unceded Mi'kmaq territory on the Atlantic coast of Nova Scotia.
So... we're here to talk about your book, Insurgent Love, Abolition, and Domestic Homicide, which was published in 2021 by Fernwood Press. And as I just said, you came to Montreal to launch the book, and the launch was hosted by Natalie Batcherville and Marlahan Lopez in December, and we recorded the event and we aired the audio. So For people who are looking for more of an introduction to the book, you can check out our December 9th, 2021 episode on our website. And today I wanted to delve a little bit deeper into the book. So I won't necessarily do as broad of an overview as Natalie and Marlahan did at the book launch with you. But I'm wondering if just to start, Ardeth, if you could take a shot at giving a short summary of the book, just in case some people haven't listened to that earlier episode.
Yeah, so Insurgent Love really grapples with the question of what do we do with the dangerous few? What do we do from an abolitionist framework with folks who are at high risk for killing their partners or who do kill their partners or members of their family? And I sort of look at the issue of domestic homicide as including both homicides that occur within the domestic sphere, within the home, within the family, and also homicides that occur through domestic security forces, such as police perpetrated killings. Because for me, from a criminological angle, it makes sense to look not just at who is killed and who's at risk in carceral society for homicide, but also the characteristics of the perpetrators. And so the book really looks at police as perpetrators of homicide alongside the typologies of who we know to be the folks who kill, the ones they're closest to.
In the book, you talk about coercive control, and in the mainstream media, it feels like coercive control is becoming a more widely understood concept, especially with the mass casualty commission into the Portapique shooting that's happening right now, or happened in the last couple weeks. The CBC ran a story back in December 2021 calling coercive control, quote, the silent partner of domestic violence. And the article said that many countries are considering or have already added coercive control laws to their repertoire of anti-domestic violence laws. So I'm just wondering if you could talk more about like the difference between coercive control and other forms of intimate partner violence. And I'm curious if you see it as like a spectrum or if these are totally different categories of things.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who's worked both with, you know, folks serving life sentences for homicide or attempted homicide, and also with surviving family members of folks who were killed by their partners, I see violence as a language, but it can communicate a lot of things. And so, you know, I don't see coercive control as on a spectrum with the other type of relationship violence, which, you know, Michael Johnson sort of coined the term situational couple violence. I see them as very different types of abuse. When we think about different types of domestic violence, we turn to the research of Michael Johnson and Evan Stark, who show that, you know, for the majority of violent relationships, situational couple violence is violence that arises situationally, you know, so during a conflict, it becomes the language that picks up where we are lacking the skills to be able to negotiate conflict with our kin and with our partners in other ways. And so families that are under a lot of stress, partners who have attachment issues, abuse histories of their own, histories of neglect or abuse in their own families, often have very high conflict and sometimes very dangerous fights and conflicts. But this form of situational couple violence, although it's, you know, the majority of domestic violence relationships, is very different than, you know, that made for TV movie sociopathic scary abuser who, you know, tracks his partner's every move and represents a serious threat to her life. And so coercive control is that type of very scary intimate terrorist type of abuse, where violence is used strategically to maintain a sense of total control and total surveillance over the partner and sometimes the children. And coercive control is the type of violence that folks fleeing domestic violence situations and living in domestic violence shelters often experience. And that's why a lot of feminists who work in the domestic violence crisis shelter system see domestic violence through the lens of coercive control. It often leads to a bit of a miscommunication because a lot of folks who are doing accountability work in communities and trying to foster non-carceral approaches to healing and accountability within families are not experiencing coercive control in the same way. So we often talk about domestic violence in really generalized terms, but for me, there's a very useful distinction because one of those forms of violence for me is about stress and historical trauma, And the other form of violence was directly taught by and brought to the territory that I live on, that most of us live on in the West, through colonial imperial powers and the way that the territory was policed and surveilled, and strategic violence was used in the earliest police forces on the territory. And so coercive control as a form of violence within a family is a direct manifestation of the same forms of violence and control used by police and in policing, and that have been used historically since the RCMP began here.
I want to dig into this, like, coercive control and the police connection that you're making. And in the book, in fact, you don't just say that, like, there is a big similarity between the way that people understand coercive control and state-sanctioned methods of policing, but that there is elements of coercive control in the capitalist system that structures our lives, like in work and occupation. You tend to use the words more work and occupation. But in terms of, like, the global capitalist system forcing everyone to work in order to house and feed themselves, that there are elements of coercive control in that too. So I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about this expanded way of understanding coercive control and what you're hoping people take away from this, like, expanded use of that term.
Yeah, so when I talk about coercive control as being a manifestation of colonial forms of policing, you know, the good news from the perspective of folks in community who want to stop domestic homicide, who want to end gender-based violence and family violence, the homicides that take place in these relationships are very preventable because there is such a clear pattern to how it unfolds, and the risk factors for homicide are really clear. And one of those risk factors actually is the relationship of the abuser to the global financial marketplace. And so, you know, in the book, I talk a little bit about, you know, this idea of possessive logic, where Eileen Morton Robinson, an Aboriginal feminist from Australia, talks about how, you know, one of the founding logics of white supremacy and settler colonialism is this idea of possessions and possessiveness. And this is related to, you know, the beginning of private property and the acquisition of land, but also related to the history of the nuclear family and the wife being the possession, the chattel of the husband. You know, that's the history of marriage as a legal institution. And so, you know, so if we're looking at preventing domestic homicide, family killings, we see that the loss of employment or employment-related precarity is often a precursor to homicide and a precursor to severe and lethal forms of violence in families. So this tells us two things. This tells us, one, that we have really good data to be able to protect those who are most vulnerable in coercive control relationships. But two, it also tells us that we need to start formulating anti-capitalist and anti-work frameworks for seeing how a lot of the lethal gender-based violence arises as a result of neoliberal precarity and insecurity in the marketplace. And, you know, we know it's not news to us. Toxic masculinity really teaches cisgendered men that their value in society is related to their value as a worker. And, you know, this total occupation of the self with one's labor identity, with the value of your identity to your employer, really means that, you know, an abuser who is using coercive and strategic control against their family faces an existential threat upon the loss of employment. And because of the white possessive logics of settler colonialism, they believe that if, you know, if they're going to take their own life, if they're facing an absolutely catastrophic existential threat through the loss of their livelihood, then they must take their chattel with them when they go. And that's where we see familicide and the killing of families and the killing of partners. It's frustrating to me. You know, I listen to forensic psychologists. I listen to feminists who do work on data crunching on intimate partner homicide. And so rarely in those fields do we talk about the relationship of domestic homicide to the global financial marketplace, but the data is clear. And so, you know, if we know that scarcity and precarity are some of the precursors to that kind of killing, that also gives us a framework with which to think through labor-based interventions with abusers as well. That opens another pathway for us to be thinking through the involvement of labor unions and also ways of working with children through the school system to develop a sense of identity that is not tied to their occupation in a monetary sense.
listening to you, you've brought this up a couple times now, so I want to like explicitly talk about it. I think your book is addressing a few different audiences at the same time, all of whom are dealing with domestic homicide prevention in a range of unhelpful ways. And one of those audiences are sometimes we call them carceral feminists, sometimes just like feminists who are much more in the like domestic violence prevention industry, who are pushing for things like coercive control laws and an analysis that centers concepts of femicide. And maybe another one of the audiences are radicals and abolitionists who are pushing for community accountability processes and defunding the cops. And I'm curious if you could say more about where your proposals and analyses, you've talked about it a bit, but if you could talk a bit more about where your proposals and analyses differ from both of these groups, actually.
Really, the arguments in my book are intended to be an intervention into a lot of the conversations happening around femicide and coercive control. One, because a lot of folks who have a lot of sway and power within the domestic violence research industry are pushing for coercive control to be criminalized as a solution to domestic homicide, which I fundamentally believe is an ineffective strategy. And it's been ineffective in every jurisdiction where they've taken a criminalization approach to these forms of severe and lethal violence. The thing that concerns me, you know, a great deal about feminists who are talking about femicide, who are talking about intimate partner homicide, is there is a real acceptance for trans exclusionary and, I would argue, very fascist strains of white feminism. And I'm using feminism scare quotes because, you know, I don't believe that fascism and trans exclusion are compatible with feminism. But, you know, within the conversations that are happening, you know, between the UK, Canada, and the United States, a lot of those anti-femicide movements become a haven for feminists who want to argue that, you know, the cause of all gender-based violence is misogyny. You know, Beth Ritchie does such a beautiful way of talking about this in her book, Arrested Justice, about how, you know, the emergence of white carceral feminist movements against gender-based violence really bracketed out anything else in the conversation about the causes of gender-based violence other than misogyny. It's a very convenient way for white feminists to conceal their complicity in settler colonialism and their complicity in white supremacy. But by saying, you know, the problem with gender-based violence is men, full stop, we don't ask the question, well, where did misogyny come from? Well, settler colonialism and racial capitalism. That's, you know, my argument is that's where misogyny is coming from. Misogyny is the symptom. It's not the answer. But it's also created a landing pad for TERFs and trans misogynists who want to argue this bioessentialist angle that men are biologically predisposed to violence, right? And that's where, you know, I think a lot of the carceral feminist movements against gender-based violence have really enabled a very harmful and growing movement of white feminists with a lot of power who are engaging in a lot of direct violence against trans women and trans folks. And so, you know, partly my argument against the criminalization of coercive control is to try to intervene and call attention to the ways in which Black feminist thought has done a much better job of conceptualizing the hugeness, the scale and complexity of the problem of family violence. You know, Black feminist thinking gives us different scales of analysis with which to understand the problem. And I think that that's a much more generative space to be looking at solutions. And, you know, in terms of responding to, you know, who a lot of my community is, or folks who are doing community accountability work, I think that what I'm hoping to offer is a different vocabulary for understanding when and where an accountability circle is the right thing to do. You know, I worked with murderers for a long time, and part of my ethic and my politics are that, you know, I want to respect the autonomy of everyone. And having respect for folks who even engaged in absolutely horrific acts of violence means acknowledging when and where they're able to heal and they're able to be accountable and participate in a process. And so, you know, having a more clear understanding, of the differences between situational couple violence and how that works within some of the models that we have for using community accountability versus when we need to be thinking about specific abusers as cops. Because I don't think many of us would have an accountability circle with police. And I think we need to be thinking about certain abusers as police, and also thinking about those folks who are not a part of our movements because they're in a coercive control relationship. And trying to hold space for the absences that I want to be remembering are there. Because, you know, one of the first things to go in family violence situations where there is coercive control is a sense of connectedness to community. And so trying to keep as many doors in, you know, in my movements and in my networks open as possible so that, you know, folks who are able to try and leave those types of relationships before it ends in homicide, that we have those doors open. And I also want to acknowledge the danger to that work. You know, I don't believe that the revolution should be dependent upon the unpaid labor, largely of queer, Black, and Indigenous women, who are the folks that I see working in accountability circles. And so, you know, I'm trying to open the door for conversations about safety in the labor of accountability, and also fair compensation, and what that would look like in terms of, you know, how do we engage with quote unquote expert knowledge that might be problematic within the domestic violence crisis shelter communities? How do we engage in ways that still uphold our abolitionist politics, but allow us to be able to work safely with folks leaving a coercive control relationship?
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We're in the middle of airing an interview with Ardeth Wynot about her book called Abolition and Domestic Homicide. In the next section, Ardeth talks about some of the things she would find more helpful in preventing domestic homicide from happening. So you offer a few directions for people to go in, for people who are looking for maybe like the start of something like a solution. And so I kind of want to get into some of those things. So one of your proposals in the book that you talk about a little bit is disarmament. I'm curious if you can talk more about what you mean by that. In the book, you talk a lot about rural communities that have access to guns. I'm sort of assuming you don't mean stricter gun control laws, because for most of the rest of the book, you're like, no, I don't think that like more laws or more criminalization will help deal with this problem. So I'm curious if you could lay out a bit more what your proposal for disarmament means.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is some settler violence against fishers here in this territory who are exercising their treaty rights to fish, fishers from Sipaganegdi, and it ended in gun violence and arson. And, you know, in many rural communities here, the standard abolitionist arguments don't make sense because rural communities don't necessarily have access to the RCMP. But the cops in those communities aren't cops. They're just guys with guns, but they behave in the exact same way. And so, you know, for me, doing outreach with and including rural communities and abolitionist movements is really vital and is pivotal to me, because there's a lot of folks I care about in those communities. My family is from a community like that. And so thinking about the abolition of policing as also the abolition of those who are functioning as de facto police, men with power and status in communities who have access to guns, because, excuse me, we know that one of the other major risk factors for homicide is access to or presence of a firearm in the home. So we know that the risk for homicide goes up if there is a firearm. So there are excellent programs that have been used in post-conflict regions, such as gun buyback programs, which I'm really a fan of, where, you know, folks are compensated for turning in their weapons, but also changing cultures in rural communities around the presence of guns and what that means. Because I think that, you know, there's a lot of really passive acceptance of firearms being present in a home, you know, in a garage. And I think that there's a lot of community-based work that can happen with allies who might not necessarily think that abolition is the way to go yet, but might agree that guns make their neighborhood less safe. And so, you know, we might not be able to completely demilitarize police, but part of disarmament is also, you know, defunding police, making sure they can't buy that tank, making sure we show up to city council meetings to try and reduce the budgets with which they arm officers and put armed folks on the streets. You know, fighting, for example, policies that allow officers to show up with their guns to work extra duty shifts, to work security at grocery stores, which is something that's happening in my town. So, you know, for me, disarmament means getting not just the gun out, but getting the person who's carrying the gun out of our spaces as much as possible. Because the work of abolition and the work of transformative justice is going to be a lot more safe if there are less guns in our community. you know, it's not going to end all homicide. It's not going to end all violence, but it will considerably reduce our risks for facing severe and lethal violence when we are trying to keep our loved ones safe.
Another one of the things that you talk about in terms of like proposals for dealing with domestic homicide from an abolitionist perspective is this idea called compassionate containment, which I'm under the impression you dealt more with in a different book that I couldn't get my hands on. And so you reference it a couple times in this book. You don't get super into it. I'm curious if you'd be down to explain that concept more too.
Yeah, I learned that concept working with I did my PhD research with women with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. So, you know, folks who've worked in prisons for a long time, you probably know that like approximately 3/4 of the women's prison population meets the diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder. And in men's prisons, it's usually ASPD, antisocial personality disorder. And so, you know, without getting into like all the politics around diagnostics and like the, you know, political utility of those as like tools for liberation, one thing I did learn is that, you know, there are the harms of neoliberalism and the harms of settler colonialism are really easy to see when we can trace a history of violence, but neglect is the thing that we don't talk about enough, because neglect feels invisible, and generations of neglect through neoliberal austerity normalize neglect so much that it's like the air we breathe and we don't see it. We don't acknowledge that it's there. It's a lot more easier to point to armed violence, to look at, say, what happened to Ashley Smith when she was duct taped to her seat on a flight and gagged. Like, we can look at that and we can say that is fundamentally morally wrong. But the neglect of her family to assist her with what she was experiencing prior to her incarceration is the thing that I want to keep front of mind, because for me, that's the territory of transformative justice, is responding to the neglect that allows violence to happen. And so, you know, what I learned from folks with BPD who like often really struggle to get care. So, you know, you're suicidal, you show up to an ER numerous times and they send you home. Like, you just can't get care. You can't get into secure psychiatric care even when you really need it and you're actively self-harming, is that freedom looks like the absence of walls and the absence of any constraints to your agency when you haven't been neglected. But when you've been neglected and no one has like held you tight when you were like wilding out and self-harming and banging your head on a wall because you were in so much pain, sometimes freedom looks like being held and cared for. And that's something that, you know, we know with children need that. We hold them and care for them when they're banging their heads on the floor, having a tantrum, when they're trying to run into traffic. There are ways that we constrain each other's agency that are acts of care and that are acts of love. And as social beings, you know, even evolutionary biologists, psychologists, child development specialists, we all know that we need that kind of like security and holding, physical holding. And so compassionate containment is idea that there are kinds of freedom that can protect someone's agency and protect someone's ability to heal, that constrain agency and hold us accountable to the best of who we are, that is not the same as the walls of a prison in a carceral society. Like, I'm trying to carve out that something else about, you know, we have folks who are dangerous, and because of the way that the carceral system is structured in settler colonialism, lots of dangerous folks are not behind bars, but some dangerous folks are. And we're not made safer by having them there for a period of years and turned out on the streets. But, you know, for folks who pose a risk to others and a risk to themselves, I do think we need to be talking about solutions that compassionately contain their ability to harm. And what that looks like, I don't know. That's not something I want to think of on my own. That's something that I want to discover through conversations with communities over time, because I think that, you know, these solutions have to be collective. But I do resist this very European, like Michel Foucault type of idea that agency means, you know, we're just floating in space without even gravity to hold us down. And, you know, anything that holds us down or constrains us in any way is somehow carcerality. I think that that is black and white, settler colonial, Eurocentric thinking. And so I'm trying to think beyond that, because a lot of the guys I work with, excuse me, in prison, they talk about one of the things, you know, when you're finally in minimum security, one of the things that is helpful and useful in their healing journey is like routine and being kept within a specific family unit, within a house on the range. And this is not me saying that prison is good, but this is me saying that having a community of folks who struggle with the same forms of causing the same forms of harm that you do, and preventing someone from further alienating themselves from society by hurting someone, like, I think those can all be acts of care.
Yeah, this gets me thinking about, I'm thinking about some of the situations that I've been through in this city where people get asked not to come to events at certain spaces or events that certain organizations are putting on, in an attempt to like distance them from people who they've hurt. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, I mean, it's just such a funny line to walk. And I'm talking about like a totally different realm of thing, because this is a, like, the kinds of harms that I've seen the communities that I'm in try to deal with on their own are not the levels of, often not the levels of harm that you're talking about in the book. But the like idea of containment as like a, we need to make this person's social world smaller for a bit so that they can't keep hurting other people in the same way that they've hurt some of the people around them. And so, you know, trying to be like, don't come to this space, don't come to these kinds of events, but like, we still want to share community with you in these other ways, and having that set up. Anyway, it's coming from a very different context, but there's echoes of what you're saying in terms of thinking through being in those situations here. And, you know, trying to deal with all the people who are like, we can never exclude someone from anything. That's carceral thinking. Or the people who are like, you know, this guy needs to get banished from the city. I never want to see him again. Like trying to like find a middle ground between both those things to like figure out something that feels like consequences, but not such harsh consequences that it will cause even more harm in like enacting those consequences. Anyway, a totally.
Yeah. No, it's true. And like what the question for me is around thresholds. Like, this is why I think we need to really build our literacy around, like, we need to build our mental health literacy big time. And we need to build our literacy around issues like stalking and gender-based violence and abuse. Because if we do that, if as communities who want to forge non-carceral movements and solutions to violence, if we have a better understanding of what each of those things look and feel like and what the harms of each of those things are, it's easier to manage the complexity and to figure out our thresholds for excluding someone. Right? Yeah. I mean, containing someone and requiring them to be in a healing space for, you know, a period of time. Maybe the threshold for that is like serious physical violence to their partner, you know, which includes choking and threats of killing and all these other risk factors that we know to go along with homicide. And I think, you know, for me, the trap is in thinking that we can scale everything down small to up high, and somehow everything is a microcosm of a bigger harm. So if we have the same solution for situational couple violence where a couple gets like violent and crosses boundaries when they're drinking versus someone who's been stalking their partner and threatening their life, I don't think we can scale those two solutions, because I think they need very different forms of healing. And it's going to mean an investment in really building our vocabulary and like creating glossaries of harm, so that when we're talking about violence and we're talking about harm, because when everything is harm, nothing is. And that's something that, you know, Yasmin Nair has written a little bit about that. And I found that really helpful for me in stopping me from trying to think about scaling down and scaling up in really simplistic ways.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. This is an interview with Ardith Wynot about her book, which is called Insurgent Love, Abolition and Domestic Homicide. In this next section, we talk a little bit about different scales of violence, from the serious interpersonal violence that Ardath calls domestic terrorism to organized right-wing militia violence. I want to talk more about the scaling up and scaling down. There's a point in the book where you write, accepting the prevalence and dangers. It's towards the end of the book, and it's, I'm just going to read a little bit of it. So it says, accepting the prevalence and dangers of high-risk intimate partner violence and domestic homicide is a test to our commitment to abolition. It requires us to grapple with the real and present dangers we live with every day. It requires us to admit that even if we defund, disarm, and dismantle the police, legions of settlers will turn up with their guns and militias and enact the same kinds of injustice and violence we are fighting so hard against. And to me, this feels like engaging with the question of scale a little bit at a time. And so I'm just curious to talk more about this like the between the scale of like, you know, someone in a relationship enacting violence against their partner and like the violence of, you know, a settler vigilante militia, like how do we talk about those two different things? Like, it feels like one of the things that ends up happening in the book is that in dealing with the most violent of intimate partner violence, you end up trying to grapple with the most violent of systemic violence. And in some sense, you like walk away a bit pessimistic at the left or even the radical left's ability to deal with either of these things, which like, yeah. Fair enough. I don't think we're at a high point for our ability to deal with these things. But yeah, I'm curious if you can talk more about this question of scale and like trying to figure out abolitionist ways of dealing with both the act of like someone approaching the edge of you know, killing their partner versus like organized white supremacist vigilantism that could easily fill the void if we abolished the police but left the settler state and capitalism intact.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's not so much about scale. It's about like training your ear to hear the different patterns in the music, right? Because the data shows that the type of interventions that are being fostered and used in communities through accountability circles, like, if we just like bump those up with a little bit of emotionally focused therapy, some like sort of stronger tools that we can like steal from clinical spaces that actually are effective, a lot of those accountability circles do work for situational couple violence. So when we want to grapple with the most dangerous of the dangerous, we're looking at the same perpetrator. Those perpetrators have strong adherence to hypermasculine and toxic self norms. Those perpetrators use violence strategically to uphold the status quo. Those perpetrators turn to possessive logics and they use violence in response to feelings of dispossession and to a robbing of their own sense of security, right? So those perpetrators, whether we're talking about someone who's involved in a right-wing militia versus a cop versus an intimate terrorist, coercive control abuser, they all look to repossess someone else as totally as possible through violence in relation to the lack of security. And so that for me is the hopeful thing. In order to understand those perpetrators and to hear the patterns in the violence altogether, to see that as a constellation that tells a story that we can respond to, that's where that word insurgent comes from. It's like this idea of fighting back. It is going to be a fight in that situation. I mean, I was raised reading Fanon, and maybe, you know, I'm not a pacifist by any means, because I think that in those situations, we don't know how much of the self of that abuser we can even access, because, you know, the forces of occupation and settler colonialism sometimes can exert such totality over someone, especially someone, you know, if we look at the shooter in Portapique, if we look at the testimony around his early life experiences, you can see that any positive sense of self or integrity of self was completely squashed and demolished and beaten out of that child, so that, you know, the forces of occupation and hyper-masculine norms began to fill up the whole container of who that person was. And so, you know, maybe I'm getting a little bit off track here, but I think that, you know, to respond to your idea of scale, I would say it's learning to dance to a different music. And if we train our ear to see those patterns, one, we get out of the trap of talking about femicide, where we're just trying to beat our heads against the wall, saying over and over again, women and girls are killed because they're women and girls. Okay, yeah, great. Misogyny, yes. Thank you. Thank you, carceral feminism. Please sit down, because now we have to talk about those who are causing the harm and why they're causing that harm. And that's where Black feminism and Indigenous feminisms and abolitionist feminisms give us the tools, I think, to hear that music. But in order to hear it, we have to stop using these totalizing terms of harm and violence and seeing all family violence as a microcosm of state violence, because I don't think that it is. And the data and the research on family violence doesn't show that it is. It's only those really scary forms that are high risk for homicide that are echoes of state violence. And those ones might require a serious, organized, potentially armed response, right? Because, you know, if we're talking about armed abusers, if we're talking about having someone leave a relationship where there is a really high potential of them losing their life, then we need to really think about that as insurgents, like as a real rebellion against something that's dangerous. And for me, I want to see the fight against coercive control as the fight against police violence and policing, as the fight against right-wing militias and settler, you know, styles of governing communities by the barrel of a gun. Because, you know, in a lot of those communities, they end up just using execution to deal with dangerous folks. In the book, I talk about the Philip Boudreau murder case, where someone who behaved that way in a community for a long time was just executed by other members of the community. And that kind of settler frontier violence is not something that I want to see in rural communities. And so, you know, I hope that the book is a small intervention into helping us hear the music a little differently between those two forms of violence, so that we don't turn to an accountability circle in every situation, and so that we can turn our attention to the folks who are not in our movements because they're in coercive control relationships, and try to make sure that we have pathways and safety pathways for them as well.
Anything that comes in the wake of 2020, which is anything that's happened since then, is coming in a context where, you know, in the wake of the cops murdering George Floyd in the summer of 2020 in the U.S., abolition became like a very widely used term, even though it didn't necessarily become more clearly defined. And so a lot of people have been grappling with that. There's been a lot of new influx of people into what I think of as like the abolitionist movement in what are now called the U.S. and Canada. And so different people have been grappling with that. And there was an article that was recently published in a journal called Endnotes. And the author, Jared Shanahan, writes a few things that I wanted to share and then see what you think of, because I suspect you two are headed in a similar direction, but I'm curious how similar or how different. So he writes, quote, "If the tenets of abolitionism are to be taken seriously, organizers and theorists in the present must engage head-on with the question of extra-parliamentary conflict with capitalism and its supporters, which will be, by necessity, a violent and thoroughly dangerous affair, nonetheless essential to escaping the death spiral of capitalism. It's no longer enough to talk about abolitionism as an imagination or a dream, as its most poetic adherents often insist. Abolition must be a coherent practical approach to abolishing class society through mass struggle, or else it is just that, a dream." And then he goes on to write, quote, "A new world organized according to the righteous principles abolitionists uphold will not just require alternatives to conflict mediation and responding to antisocial behavior. It will also require the collectivization on a mass scale of the means by which we labor and live." And I'm curious if that resonates at all with you, if there are things that you're like, no, I wouldn't frame it that way. And what you make of assessments of the abolitionist movement in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, in the wake of the summer of 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like a white, cisgendered, queer woman, and I don't make a practice of telling movements outside of the territory that I reside on how to do things, you know, or even really assessing those movements. It doesn't feel good to me. It feels too close to white supremacy. But I will say that I think, you know, from my perspective and from where I sit in Nova Scotia here on the Atlantic coast, I think that the cost of abolition making inroads is going to be more militias, more mass shootings, more very damaged and dangerous white men feeling dispossessed. I mean, that is the goal of the movement. And the goal of the movements, if they're successful, is going to bring feelings of insecurity and dispossession to folks who feel an entitlement to that. But the thing that makes me feel hopeful is that, you know, in Canada right now, we have huge amounts of our territories that are not policed, where RCMP presence is very small. And I think that those communities can really be pathways to understanding. You know, small populations can mean small investments in projects for transformative justice that would really improve relations in smaller regions. And I do think that you know, although there are a lot of guns in rural areas of Canada specifically, I do think that there are, you know, sort of slow and steady incremental bits of change that we can accomplish that way. You know, I see groups like the Bear Clan operating out west, doing really incredible work. And I mean, you know, there's arguments over whether they've been co-opted by receiving federal funding, but, you know, having other forms of community care, having civilian staffed mental health crisis response teams. For me, one of the areas that I'm really interested in working in that is not gonna necessarily lead to full-scale rebellion, but is that working with first responders, firefighters and medics do an incredible amount of public safety work. And they're like at the forefront of every social problem that should make a convincing case for transformative justice towards abolition. And so, you know, one of the areas that I would like to work in is not grouping all first responders together with police and trying to break down this idea of solidarity between, you know, volunteer firefighters and police forces, but really looking at investing in those 911 response movements so that they have a sense of self-identity as something towards transformative justice, specifically medics. And I think that, you know, taking an occupational perspective and sort of battling settler colonialism and racial capitalism through making the work of healing and making the work of transformative justice sustainable and healthy, and improving working conditions for nurses, medics, primary school teachers who are dealing with kids in, you know, traumatized families, decarcerating social work and occupational therapy. There's some really incredible movements happening to radicalize those professional bodies. And so, you know, all of those things are piecemeal on their own, but taken together, I think that they exert critical force towards the center of power in ways that, you know, as a whole can be successful. So I don't think it's always going to be a fight. And I do think that there are other avenues we need to take, but I do agree that, you know, there is going to be increased stability and increased violence. And we've definitely seen that through the frequency and intensity of shootings happening in the United States since the death of George Floyd. But again, the good news is that type of perpetrator that we see that causes mass tragedy on that level, you know, we can deal with in the same way we deal with cops. We can deal with through disarmament. We can deal with through understanding how those perpetrators work and disentangling those forces of colonial violence that operate within them.
You're still listening to the Prison Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM. This is the final segment of our interview with Ardith Wynot, author of Insurgent Love, Abolition and Domestic Homicide. In this section, we talk about Prisoner Justice Day, which was on August 10th, and how Ardith marks that day in her life. We're conducting this interview on August 2nd, but it's going to air on August 11th, which technically is our Prisoner Justice Day show, but I won't have time to compile all the audio from the event that is happening in Montreal on August 10th around Prisoner Justice Day to air on the 11th. So our audio from Prisoner Justice Day will air on our second show in August, which is going to be on August 26th, which is a Friday. So our like 11 a.m. Friday show will be where you'll get to hear a bunch of the audio from the Montreal PJD event. But in your book, you talk a lot about prisoners who or guys who've spent a lot of time inside who have impacted how you think about these things. And, you know, for people who don't know, Prisoner Justice Day is a day that started in the federal prisons in Canada in the mid-70s to commemorate people who've died inside, often people who've died in really horrific conditions because, you know, the cops turned off the panic buttons in their cells and were, you know, when you talk about neglect, like neglect on that level that leads to people dying is still a huge thing in prison. And so every year on August 10th, people get together and commemorate people who've died inside. And I was just curious if you could like reflect on that a little bit, maybe bring back some of the people who have influenced you and your thinking around this, who have spent a lot of years in prison, and yeah, share a little bit of that kind of thing with us.
I mean, I'm so grateful for a lot of the relationships I've had with folks who are living decades of their lives in prison. You know, I think one of the great tragedies of the prison industrial complex is that we have folks inside who have tremendous insight and capacity and wisdom to understand what healing could and should look like for the most dangerous few. And so, you know, I think that one of the things that I would want to see in a transformative justice movement against domestic homicide is really engaging with those who have, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago done similar crimes and really working with them in the same way that COSA works with, you know, sex offenders and folks who perpetrated sexual violence to engage in the healing of others. I think that we can do that with homicide too, because there is a real profound, terrible sacredness to the space of, you know, two folks who've taken a life grappling with what that means together, because taking the life of someone robs them and their family of happiness and joy and of that life, but it also really harms the person who does it. And so, and you know, there are folks who shield themselves from experiencing regret and remorse, and you know, we have all these ways that we try to cope with not feeling the harms that we've done. But you know, when you heal and you do feel it, it is profound and it is terrible, and it is something that only someone who's done it can understand. And I think that healing with homicide requires us to have folks who know, who have been there, who have been that guy, who have been that coercive control abuser. And there have been some pretty incredible programs in Spring Hill. About a decade ago, there were some pilot programs here that really engaged with guys to assist in each other's healing. And of course, the Harper era cut all the funding to those programs. But, you know, I would just say that I've never met someone in prison who wasn't also a survivor. And I think that, you know, part of honoring the lives lost in jail and the lives taken by those who are living in jail, he's also looking after the kids and the children of folks who are inside and kids in our communities today to make sure that they don't, you know, fall through the cracks, that they don't experience the same types of violence that the guys inside I met, you know, have talked to me about when they were kids. And that's one way that, you know, every year on PJD, I think about the stories I heard from men and women in prison and what their early lives were like. And I always make a point to try and think about youth in my life who might be there right now and the way I can contribute to my community to intervene on the outside as a way to honor who's inside.
What's next for you? Like, what are you working on now that you've put this book out? You've toured a little bit with this book. Have you set your sights on a new goal? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, I'm really interested in this idea of a moral injury, which is like the harm that happens when there's a failure to protect. Like, this is something we talk about with cops and soldiers a lot. You know, soldiers who witness other soldiers committing like mass killings of civilians. There's like a particular kind of harm that comes to the self and the spirit. And it's being highly medicalized right now in like psychiatric and psychological literature, but I'm really interested in working with former cops, whistleblower cops, medics, veterans for abolition, because, you know, I've interviewed and I've talked to a lot of former cops who became whistleblowers who are now abolitionists. And I think that they have such a convincing series of stories. And, you know, this idea of moral injury for me is really about the failure of the state to protect those who are vulnerable and the failure of those who should care for others to care for others. It's something that in the pandemic we've talked about, you know, chronic underfunding of the healthcare system has led to high rates of suicide amongst doctors and nurses and clinical staff. And a lot of that has to do with moral injury. So seeing people who should be helped not getting the help that they need because of capitalism and neoliberal austerity. And so, you know, it's not very anarchist of me to really focus on the failure of the state to protect, but, you know, I'm really interested in working with folks who've experienced moral injury on the front lines of the settler colonial state and the carceral state, and really working to bring those stories together and build a bit of a movement of, you know, first responders and frontline workers for abolition.
My next question is, how can people find your book? And I include folks on the inside. Like, is there a way for people on the inside to get their hands on your book?
Yeah, so I will send copies inside. If anyone is in jail and wants a copy, just send me a note, send me your address and whatever the process is for getting books accepted, because I know some federal prisons books have to be okayed if they're going to head to the library. Excuse me. But you can get the book on Fernwood's website. I know they did have a deal going on for a while. The book won an award for scholarly writing, so they had like a 20% off, which I think is still up there. If you're in the United States, you can get the book through Columbia University Press. Or you can go into your local indie bookstore and ask them to order it if you want to support an indie bookstore.
Very cool. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a really interesting conversation, and I hope that people who are listening enjoy it as well. We always try and wrap up by asking if there was anything that you wanted to talk about that you didn't feel like you got to talk about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time just talking about murder and self-harm and severe and lethal violence. So, yeah, I hope anyone's listening, if that triggers stuff for you, just don't feel those feelings alone. Feel them in kin with folks who care about you and love you, and try to talk about it and then move on and have a good day.
That was Ardith Wynot talking to us about her book, Abolition and Domestic Homicide. If you want to hear more about the book, you can check out the December 9th episode of our radio show, where we aired audio from her book launch in Montreal, which happened in November 2021. Her book is available on Fernwood Press, and if you're inside and want a copy, reach out to us and we'll put you directly in touch with Ardath. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and prisonradioshow.libsyn.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Prison Radio Show. Parts of our show are also available through podcasting apps. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. The next show will air on Friday, August 26th, 11 a.m. As I said at the top of the show, that show will feature a bunch of content from Prisoner Justice Day events which happened across the country. If you don't know what Prisoner Justice Day is, it is a commemorative day that was started in federal prisons in Canada in the 1970s to commemorate people who have died in prison. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved in the show, feel free to contact us. We're at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. You can also call us Collect. We're at 514-876-3748 from Bordeaux or RDP. We're an all-volunteer show, though, so we don't always have someone who can answer the phone. So if you don't get through, just keep trying, and hopefully at some point someone will get to the phone. You can also leave a message. We have a regular cell phone number. It's 438-337-8423. If you're in prison, you can also send us mail. Our mailing address is The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec. Spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. The show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chojage, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, August 11th, 2022. A retro show tonight. This week's archive show looks back on some of my favorite conversations so far this year on movement, tap, stepping, and circus. On tonight's show, my guests. Travis Knight is an ambassador of the hidden history of jazz and tap and black artists, but insists that at the end of the day, he sees his job as pretty straightforward.
I've traveled the world, I've lived here and there, I've toured. It's all great. I've been blessed. Fantastic. But at the beginning and the end of every day, what it all boils down to is the dance itself. And everything else is